This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Good afternoon. My name is Andrew Seri. I'm Dean of the Graduate Division. And we are pleased, along with the Hitchcock Professorship Committee and the Graduate Council, to present Professor John Heilbrunn, this year's speaker in the Charles and Martha Hitchcock Lecture Series. As a condition of this bequest, it's my pleasure to tell you how the endowment came to UC Berkeley. It's a story that exemplifies the many ways this campus is linked to the history of California and the Bay Area. Dr. Charles Hitchcock, a physician for the Army, came to San Francisco during the Gold Rush, where he opened a thriving private practice. In 1885, Charles established a professorship here at Berkeley as an expression of his long-held interest in education. His daughter, Lily Hitchcock Coit, still treasured in San Francisco for her colorful personality as well as her generosity, greatly expanded her father's original gift to establish a professorship at Berkeley, making it possible for us to present a series of lectures. The Hitchcock Fund has become one of the most cherished endowments of the University of California, recognizing the highest distinction of scholarly thought and achievement. And for this, we are grateful to the Hitchcocks. I now invite William Lester, Professor of Chemistry and Chair of the Hitchcock Committee, to the podium to say a few words about Professor John Heilbrunn. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew. John Heilbrunn has made fundamental contributions as an historian of science. His work sets the history of the physical sciences within its wider cultural context. Heilbrunn is best known for his writings on the history of physics and astronomy, but the full breadth of his expertise ranges from early experiments in electricity and European solar observatories to the work of Ernest O. Lawrence and Max Planck. His works are highly regarded for illuminating the technical complexities of science as well as the social and political context in which it has been advanced. His current research interests include relations between science and religion in the 17th and 18th centuries, physics and its institutions in the 20th century, and the use of history of science in the teaching of science. After graduating from San Francisco's Lowell High School, Heilbrunn obtained all of his degrees at UC Berkeley, earning his B.A. and M.A. in physics and his Ph.D. in history. Heilbrunn taught at the University of Pennsylvania for 3 years and returned to UC Berkeley's history department in 1967. As a professor at UC Berkeley, Heilbrunn created the Office for the History of Science and Technology, which he directed from 1973 until his retirement in 1994. He was named Class of 1936 Professor of History and History of Science in 1985, and also served as the Vice Chancellor under Chancellor Chang Lin Tien. This was 1990 to 1994, and Chair of the Berkeley Division of the Academic Senate from 1988 to 1990. Since retiring in 1994, Heilbrunn has served as a visiting professor at the California Institute of Technology, Yale University, and UC Berkeley. In 2002, the Bancroft Library awarded him the Hubert Howe Bancroft Award to honor his, quote, significant achievements in the support of historical research and scholarship, close quote. He has also received the Sarton Medal from the History of Science Society, the Abraham Pais Prize for History of Physics, awarded jointly by the American Physical Society and the American Institute of Physics, and the Premio Internazionale Galileo Galilei. Heilbrunn is a foreign member of the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences and an honorary fellow of Worcester College, Oxford, England, where he now resides. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Professor John Heilbrunn.
Good afternoon. I was overwhelmed to be invited to give the Hitchcock lectures and humbled by the list of previous lecturers. It includes many great physicists like Niels Bohr, Enrico Fermi, and Steve Chu, and two historians, one of whom was a saint, or anyway the patron saint of my discipline, George Sarton. He gave 8 lectures, perhaps more than the audience required, on medieval science and culture. His ecstatic report of his visit opens with the memorable phrase, "No university, certainly no American university, has done so much to promote the history of science as the University of California." That was in 1933. The university has continued to support the subject generously, for which I was and am immensely grateful. However, I fear that Sarton could not give priority to Berkeley today, not only because he's dead, but more importantly, because Harvard, with which he was associated, and a few other places now devote substantially greater resources to the subject than we do. I'm sure that the powerful administrators present here today can right this historic wrong. The high medieval culture extensively described by Sarton was made of a surprisingly durable alloy of pagan and Christian elements. Tough though it was, however, the alloy deformed irreversibly under the weight of such events as the European discovery of the New World, the Protestant Reformation, the rise of belligerent nation states, and the recovery and printing of ancient authorities in conflict with the Aristotelian basis of scholastic learning. At the high culture end, these events prompted the creation of a newly vigorous physics and a newly corrosive history. The rise and early development of these twin destroyers of the medieval world picture are the subject of my lectures. Now, it's not news that the medieval world picture is dead, or that it faded during the 16th and died during the 17th century. Where I think that I may have added something to the story is an argument that in the transformation from the medieval to the early modern world picture, the historical sciences worked in tandem with, and sometimes more strongly than, the physical sciences. My lectures turn on a set of parallels intended to show that both sets of sciences obtained their modern impulses from the same sources and grew strong by appeal to similar arguments. So here is the course of today's lecture. Throughout, I shall have to stomp roughshod over pastures long cultivated by scholars with tweezers and nail scissors. I beg their forgiveness, and yours too, for any damage I might do to academic hedges and flower beds by omitting many useful and perhaps some necessary qualifications. One hedge I must make at the outset. In today's lecture, I use physics, as my early modern actors did, to refer to the study of the entire natural world from astrology to zoology. So, to the situation around 1550. I begin my story around 1550 when Copernicus, Vesalius, Paracelsus, and the recovered Archimedes quickened criticism of the medieval universe, and when the political histories of Machiavelli and Guicciardini, the recovery of Tacitus and Polybius, and the discovery of the value of medieval documents in religious and legal disputes began to transform the writing of history. Which proves that I'm not a Christian chronicler of the type still current around 1550, for if I were, I would have begun at the beginning, with creation, some 4,000 years before Augustus Caesar, and continued year after year, down to my own time, with one damn thing after another. If I were more concerned with national than with university, or with the universal history, I probably would have begun with the descendants of the sons of Noah, or better, with the diaspora following the fall of Troy, which had the advantages of moving the action forward and boasting a classic of Latin literature, Virgil's Aeneid, as a pattern. Many members of the present European Union once traced their founding to fertile Trojans, like Hector's son Francio and Aeneas's grandson Brutus, whom the Brits call Brute. Medieval writers often used this device to launch their histories and to give their kings a pedigree as old as Romulus. The practice was still alive in the 16th century when Jean Baudin allowed a Trojan origin to the Gauls and the odd abbot Johannes Trithemius invented an eponymous King Frank of Trojan descent to replace fanciful Francio. And if I wrote in the humanist tradition in 1550, I would not write history as my colleagues in Dwinell Hall do today. Humanist history belonged to the art of rhetoric, learned along with the ancient languages and applied as a source of uplifting or instructive examples. The stoicism of Cato, the prudence of Fabius Maximus, the misbehavior of almost everyone, and more recently, the battles and intrigues of Italian princelings illustrated the rewards of virtue and the wages of sin. There was no point in trying to check the truth of these stories, for who could know better than the ancients what the ancients did, or more about recent happenings than the eyewitnesses who wrote about them? And in any case, there was no market for nuances that would blur the stories, the lessons, and the rationale of history. In short, and to rough first approximation, around 1550, secular history was a part of rhetoric in search of exemplars and origins. Ecclesiastical history was a true chronicle anchored in scripture and the annals of medieval clerics. And national history was a mixture of myth, wars, dynasties, disaster, and self-promotion. What's changed, I suppose you'll ask. To be sure, there was indication of change in the writings of Machiavelli, Guicciardini, and other disingenuous commentators on the then recent past, and in the philological criticism developed by Lorenzo Valla and other Italian rhetoricians. Coming out to the cosmos, as it was seen roughly around 1550 by literate people who were not mathematicians. It was then still much as Dante saw it on his journey to paradise 250 years earlier. So here he is with Beatrice visiting the third heaven, inhabited by formerly lusty Venusians. Astrologers will notice that Venus appears on the left, the far left, in both her zodiacal houses, the Bull and the Balance. The travelers then gradually ascended to the sphere of the stars. This picture was Greek in what may be called its spatial aspects, symmetrical, unchanging, with no beginning and no anticipated end. Its marriage to Christian theology in the 13th century provided it with a temporal dimension. The standard illustrations of the late medieval universe have a Greek part, consisting of a celestial region composed of ether or quintessence, in which the planets and the stars, the sun and the moon, circulate eternally around a stationary earth, and a sublunary sphere composed of the earth at the center, with its surrounding layers of water, air, and fire, eternally in flux. The Christian part is linear, stretching from the damned at the pit of the universe to the saved beyond the stars. Here is a prelapsarian version showing God resting on the seventh day before the invention of sin, and so there is no pit. Humans came into existence with the earth, or maybe a day or two later, and would continue, despite the fall, to lord it over all other terrestrial creatures until the end, some 6,000 years after the beginning. Meanwhile, humankind would continue to suffer in the flesh for Adam's sin, which, as interpreted by Greek physiology, meant to experience imbalances in their black bile and other humors provoked by bad habits and astral influences. This cocoon-like world picture was not very helpful to mathematicians, physicians, and theologians of the later 16th century when they went about their professional business. Mathematical astronomers could not predict the places of the planets from a geocentric universe of concentric spheres turning eternally at constant velocity. The ancient authority on the humoral system, Galen, had made gross errors in human anatomy, which he had inferred from cutting up animals. And there was much more to eschatology than Dante's vision included. Anyone wanting exact knowledge needed more refined tools. Astronomers turned to mathematics, which, however, made use of models in conflict with the cosmos of concentric spheres. Anatomists turned to systematic human dissection and found the circulation of the blood, the lymphatic system and other structures in conflict with the teachings of the medical schools. They did not hide their novelties. Theologians tried to formulate exegetical principles that would accommodate information like the existence of Americans, about which the scriptures and the fathers were silent. Experts lived, as they often do, in discordant worlds. I turn now to the logic of practice, which is supposed to change the situation I have just described. The applications of mathematics to natural philosophy was driven largely by practical interests, navigation for exploration, commerce, and conquest. Calendrics for liturgy, chronology, and the conversion of the Chinese. That's a Belgian Jesuit you see before you. Astrology for improving life. Ballistics for ending it. And architecture, surveying, hydraulics, and after the invention of the telescope, optical instruments. These items were bundled together with astronomy, mechanics, optics, and pneumatics into what the later 17th century called physico-mathematics. Here is an indication of the apparatus required by the up-to-date early modern physico-mathematician. History, too, owed its break from rhetoric, exemplary tales, and ecclesiastical chronicles to practical concerns. During the second half of the 16th century, the great scholars on either side of the Protestant Reformation invoked history to authenticate their communions, and a generation or two of French lawyers rewrote history and law in order to free the France of their day from previous and current entanglements with Rome. In both cases, the application required extensive engagement with the Middle Ages, a subject despised or ignored by Italian humanists, and books and research groups equal to the task. I begin with the mathematicians and the philosophers. The problem of forging a reliable union of physics and astronomy, or philosophy and mathematics, goes back to antiquity. A solution satisfactory to the philosophers was reached on the principle that, and I hope I do not offend anyone, the principle that there is no truth in mathematics. Mathematicians can describe phenomena exactly, using whatever contrivances they think most convenient, but to accept points without dimension, chords without weight, planes without frictions, epicycles, eccentrics, equants, wave functions, as existing objectively is, according to 16th century ideas, to misunderstand both nature and science. An important, and perhaps the most important achievement of the scientific revolution was to overcome the ancient dichotomy between mathematics and physics. Quantitative arguments could then be brought to bear effectively against qualitative generalizations. Let me give you an early example, the attempt to measure the universe by stellar parallax. You all know what that is. By putting the Earth in motion, Copernicus made possible the detection of a stellar parallax 25,000 times smaller than the minimum detectable from a stationary Earth. This was by making the stations from which you could measure the parallax the diameter of the Earth's orbit apart rather than the diameter of the Earth apart. Since astronomers still could not discern any displacement of the stars, they had to conclude that the universe was at least 25,000 times larger than the Greeks had left it. That was not the least of what the Holy Inquisition later called the philosophical absurdities of heliocentrism. Where was the perpetual wind arising from the supposed turning of the Earth? In order to have the quantitative advantages of the Copernican hypothesis, like an unambiguous calculation of planetary distances, without the attendant absurdities, most of the few people who knew about it before 1600 withdrew to the default position. Mathematics is useful, but not truthful. In so doing, they could claim the authority of Copernicus himself, who had appeared to warn his readers not to take as fact hypotheses he intended as fictions, lest, and I quote his words directly, lest you have leave the study of astronomy a greater fool than when you entered it. In fact, his warning did not come from Copernicus, but from his editor, a theologian, who thought that the traditional understanding of mathematical constructs as fictions might protect the work, the book, from other theologians. Another mathematical challenge to the cocoon model in the later 16th century was the determination by parallactic measurements that comets and supernovae, such as the nova that lighted up Cassiopeia's chair in 1572, ran their courses where theory forbade their appearance. The heavens apparently were not eternally the same. They too must have a history. The main author of these discoveries and conclusions, Tycho Brahe, could work his prodigies of measurement because the king of Denmark, eager for glory and sound astrology, and perhaps also for better navigation, gave him an island on which to build an observatory and perfect naked eye astronomy. Copernicus also was asked to make his knowledge useful, but he rejected a call to Rome to advise on the reform of the calendar. The effect of mathematics in altering physics may be followed on the Earth as well as in the heavens. Archimedes' approach to mechanical and hydrostatic problems, his method of abstraction that paradoxically yielded concrete results, and his legendary military accomplishments, such as incinerating the Roman fleet, made him a heroic figure to applied mathematicians after the publication of a Greek and Latin edition of his works in 1544. Galileo became a master at using Archimedes' methods to destroy physical propositions that Aristotle had intended merely as qualitative. He, that is Galileo, met a lot of resistance from people in positions of power who refused to allow mathematical hypotheses to puncture a physical system in such perfect harmony with common sense and scripture as the old cocoon universe. I come now to the practical applications of history in the hands of theologians and lawyers. During the same half century that physics first wrestled with Copernicus and Archimedes, that's the second half of the 16th century, practice was enlarging and redefining the domain of history. Theologians strove to make the case for their confession on historical grounds with, as Berkeley's historiographer James Westfall Thompson put it, incalculable significance for the development of historical scholarship. To show that the bishops of Rome had distorted the teachings of the early church and usurped its authority, Protestants used technical historical arguments against Catholic claims, much as up-to-date astronomers use mathematics against the Christianized Aristotelian cosmos. The most productive of these reverend spin doctors was Matthias Flaccius Illyricus, a leading Lutheran theologian and a very hot controversialist. He set up shop in Magdeburg with four colleagues, seven studiosi, or graduate students, and payment from Protestant princes to trace the rivulet of true Christianity and the flood of papal pretension from Christ to Luther. This precocious research group, historians preceded physicists, incidentally, in working in groups, this precocious research group printed 13 stout volumes between 1559 and 1574 and reached the 14th century before the death of Flaccius ended their work. The group arranged their materials in blocks of 100 years, which earned their books the informal title of Magdeburg Centuries and them the novel title, not novel name of Centuriators. Over half of the work is given to dogma, liturgy, and theology, and much of the balance to the progress of Antichrist, that is, the papacy, which in the judgment of the centuriators was as dangerous to the true faith as the institution of Islam. Here is one version of their attitudes. If you are Protestant, read the left, and if you are Catholic, don't read the right. There you find Flaccius's idea of the worship of idols, the worship of money, and so on, depicted under the sermon of a fat monk, whereas on the left side you have only reasonable people attending to the words of a scholar as they take communion in two kinds. In pursuing these themes, that is the history of the church from Christ to Luther, with the help of manuscripts that Flaccius and his postdocs turned up in libraries from Hungary to Scotland, the Magdeburg group assembled many facts not easily answered and pointed their argument by reference to forgeries, such as the well-known donation of Constantine, on which the Holy See rested some of its spiritual and temporal claims. The fight against the blind fanatics inspired by the devil, as the centuriators described the forgers, had its excitement. One centuriator died suddenly, poisoned, it was said, by counter-reformers unhappy at his supplying documents from Catholic libraries for Protestant causes. Catholics found their champion in Cesare Baronio, an Oratorian priest who very nearly became pope and may be on his way to canonization. Although he had not wanted the assignment, his boss, St. Philip Neri, judged him the equal of a dozen centuriators, and so he informed him by telepathy. For 28 years, the venerable Baronio did nothing but take notes and copy extracts from the material put at his disposal in the Vatican Library. Then came the folios, 12 of them at the rate of one every 18 months. The series began with the action-packed title page you see on your right, in which Saints Peter and Paul stand on their pedestals and a female figure representing the Catholic Church holds a cross to which are chained an old hag representing heresy and a man representing other uncooperative people. Baronio's annals were a great success among Catholics, although to say the truth, they are unreadable. Like the Magdeburg centuries, they devote one volume to every 100 years since the birth of Christ, listing year by year the popes, emperors, saints, and so on, all to show, as Baronio put it, that the visible monarchy of the Catholic Church, instituted by Christ and founded on the rock of Peter, has been conserved inviolate through his legitimate and true successors, that is to say, the Roman popes. At first, it appeared that Baronio's folios had crushed the centuriators. Then the technicians went to work. James I of England hired a great scholar, Isaac Casaubon, to look for mistakes in Baronio's work. It was a slam dunk. Casaubon found enough errors in Baronio's first volume to inspire 800 pages of criticism. Another energetic expert found 8,000 in the whole work, and even the Catholics had to admit that their gladiator had little judgment and less Greek. We need not follow further the low and learned appropriation of historical documents for the high purpose of confirming faith. It is enough to say that each round brought to light cornucopias of information and buckets of spin, fuel at once to historians, controversialists, and cynics. Lawyers writing in France during the civil and religious wars of the later 16th century gave as strong a shove to historical studies as the theologians who tracked the pure streams of Christianity. Here the Gallican cause, which asserted independence of France and the French Church from Rome, played the part of confessional conflict, which peaked in 1572 in the massacre of Protestants by Catholics in commemoration of the flaying of Saint Bartholomew. The lawyers, the best known of whom now is Jean Bodin, relied on the philological tools developed by Italian humanists to subvert the common belief that French civil law derived directly from Roman precedents. Similarly, they showed that the famous Code of Justinian, taught as a model of rational design in European law schools, hardly had the coherence it claimed. Like technical astronomy, it had been knocked together from bits and pieces from different times and places. With this insight, François Hotman, a choleric controversialist, longtime civil lawyer, one-time royal historiographer, and part-time secretary to Calvin himself, sweated over medieval manuscripts to discover the true customary law of France. Hotman and his colleagues wanted to ground French law and institutions on the supposedly free oligarchies of the German tribes. He derived France, not from Francio, whom he relegated to poetry, but from Frank, free. Like the Protestant theologians, he sought to recover the true pure fountain, in this case of laws, custom, and government, not primarily to enrich historical studies, but to tip the balance in contemporary political and religious battles. But again, like the theologians, he and his colleagues dug up all sorts of original information about the Middle Ages in trying to demonstrate their preferred form of Gallicanism and the roots of French feudal law and institutions. Étienne Pasquier, perhaps the best historian among the 16th century lawyers, might qualify as the Copernicus of French historiography for putting France rather than Rome at the center of historical interest. No medieval records, however repelled him. Acts of Parliament, papal bulls, coins, travel reports, chronicles, trial records. He was the first, incidentally, to look at the trial records of Joan of Arc. With copious documents and exact philology, he said, the rise and fall of states could be explained and even predicted by methods as, quote, easily grasped as mathematical demonstrations. That was to invoke a dubious ally. Contemporaries who knew there is no truth in mathematics suspected there was little in history written as a legal brief or an ecclesiastical history compiled by controversialists. Even people with the best credentials turned out to be liars. For example, Ennius of Viterbo, a Dominican theologian and professor of theology, who made up most of the matter he claimed to derive from the lost books of Berosus the Babylonian. And Abbot Trithemius, a good Benedictine, though a magician, who invented the 18 ancient books from which he wrote the history of the Franks from Troy to Clovis. How was one to know what to believe? I come to skepticism and its defeat. An easy solution was to accept a religious confession as a leap of faith and deny that anything else could be known with certainty. This feckless policy was recommended not only by the confusion of the times, but also by the writings of the grandfather of all skeptics, Sextus Empiricus, who was awakened from his slumbers in the later 16th century to supply Montaigne's generation with many finely crafted arguments subversive of all dogmatisms. Sextus observed that a criterion was necessary to resolve disputes, and that to establish the criterion, another would be needed, and so ad infinitum. The bottom line of this Pyrrhonism is that we cannot know whether any knowledge claim is true. How comforting. If no world picture could truly be said to be true, why fight over any? Only a madman would allow himself to suffer punishment for insisting on the truth of a history or cosmology offensive to his community, which, of course, would be equally crazy if it acted from conviction that it knew the truth rather than from concern to maintain public order. However useful in undercutting dogmatism, Pyrrhonism is not a satisfactory long-term strategy. It allows only a temporary withdrawal from the struggle to understand the universe and the place of human beings in it. John Locke's Pyrrhonist King of Siam may have been an impeccable epistemologist when he refused to believe the Dutch ambassador's tale about water so hard an elephant could walk upon it. But in rejecting this true report, he deprived himself of the chance of winning a Nobel Prize for the physics of freezing. Perhaps a greater danger is run by people like Sir Kenelm Digby, an ancient ornament of my Oxford College, who credited the so-called salve of sympathy on the say-so of a gentleman and a monk. This salve healed a wound when applied to the weapon that had caused it. And although the ointment no doubt was more helpful to the victim when smeared on the weapon than on the wound, in neither place did it advance medical science. In abandoning the relative safety of Pyrrhonism, the inquiring mind needed prophylactics against the gullibility of a Digby and the incredulity of the King of Siam. The criterion in physics. The two most influential solutions to the problem of this criterion during the scientific revolution originated among people who, because of their line of work, implicitly rejected Pyrrhonism. These were lawyers and Jesuits. The lawyer-like solution came from Francis Bacon, who rose to the pinnacle of the English bar under James I. The Jesuit-like solution came from that preternatural product of their pedagogy, René Descartes. Curiously, Bacon much admired Jesuit teaching, and Descartes studied to be a lawyer. They began by unraveling what remained of the cocoon universe. Bacon did so by identifying certain idols or prejudices and thought patterns which blocked access to truth about the natural world and perverted attempts to transmit the little secure information that had been discovered. Descartes jettisoned even more, indeed everything but his own mind, by doubting the existence of the external world and everything that any philosopher had ever said about it. To rebuild, Bacon proposed the collection of all available information about the external world from every likely source and its assortment into natural histories of related phenomena. Careful analysis would then produce trial hypotheses about their relationships. Systematic experiment would eliminate most of the hypotheses, and eventually a series of crucial experiments would determine the correct world picture. To achieve this goal, Bacon designed a costly research establishment, which he called Solomon's House. As you see, I hope, it boasted an observatory, botanical and zoological gardens, instruments for what he called twisting the lion's tail, that is, for experimenting under conditions not found in nature, a mine, orchard, farm, hospital, workshops of all kinds in which experiments could be conducted and their fruits applied, and an extensive system of espionage in case foreigners had discovered something the Solomons had overlooked. The design was premature when proposed in the 1620s. Bacon couldn't get James to fund it. It was revived rhetorically some 40 years later in the Royal Society of London, which unabashedly, without Pyrrhonist reservations, claimed to seek natural knowledge. It is still doing so. Descartes' analysis left him with a weapon more powerful even than Bacon's, that is, the criterion of his own conviction. Any proposition that struck him as clearly and distinctly as the great truth, I doubt, therefore, my mind exists, now best known in the soundbite, cogito ergo sum, must be true. Incidentally, the ultimate ground of the validity of this test was the inference from God's goodness that he would not deceive Descartes about any matter that Descartes grasped clearly and distinctly, a proposition that Einstein later rendered in the terms, God is clever but not malicious. The first and fundamental truth about nature that Descartes' test secured was that the material world consists of a very few primary qualities, qualities easily quantified, like extension and mobility, from which it followed, forgive me for not explaining how, that the universe is full of suns placed at the centers of vortices in which the planets swim. Those things that look like chili peppers over on the left are comets. That demoted almost all of the myriad substantial qualities of the Aristotelian worldview, like hotness and moistness and magnetism and dogginess, to secondary effects created in the perceiving mind. Despite the arrogance of the argument, Descartes' universe of pushes and whirlpools, of animal machines and disembodied minds, very quickly gained adherence, particularly among young doctors dissatisfied with the teachings of Galen and the rigidity of the medical establishment. Although many of his special arguments and mechanisms did not survive long, his insistence that a true physics, that is, a mathematical and mechanical philosophy, which would have been considered an oxymoron 100 years earlier, could be found, that inspired many deep minds of the later 17th century, including Leibniz's and Newton's. The strength of mechanism as a weapon against Pyrrhonism lies in its appeal to the intuition. As the Victorian physicist who came as close as may be possible to reducing all physical phenomena to strictly mechanical principles like to say, thinking about a mechanical universe is as easy as imagining yourself inside a steam engine. Perhaps the strongest criticism that Bacon and Descartes leveled at received learning was its uselessness, and each promised that his method would, in Bacon's phrase, improve man's estate. Given sufficient resources, they would reveal the operations of the body, build a rational medicine, and lengthen human life. In fact, neither of them had sense enough to come in out of the cold. Bacon is said to have caught his death while stuffing a chicken with ice, although it is more likely that he died from swallowing his own medicines before Solomon's house had approved them. Descartes caught his death while instructing Christina, the philosophical queen of Sweden, in the principles of his system at 2 a.m. in her frozen palace in Stockholm. These stories, which tell us that the true savant is heedless of health in the pursuit of truth, are an example of history as a branch of rhetoric. That brings me to the criterion in history. Historians obtain their criterion by privileging material survivals of the past over the writings of their colleagues. The up-to-date historian must have inscriptions, statues, candelabra, sarcophagi, coins, seals, and gems, which did not lie. In this way, the distinction between primary and secondary qualities introduced against the Aristotelian worldview had an exact parallel in the essential distinction between primary and secondary sources in historical research. Furthermore, the privileging of physical artifacts among primary historical sources had much the same psychological appeal as the preference for mechanical concepts among primary qualities. For just as the supposition of a mechanical universe stimulated the imaginations of natural philosophers, so handling ancient coins or puzzling out old inscriptions gave susceptible souls the feeling of the presence of Rome. A single artifact might be difficult to date and interpret, but with enough items, with large enough collections, careful comparison would elicit the historical truth as faithfully and in much the same manner as Bacon's philosophers winnowed out physical truth. The business of the antiquary, the collection and comparison of relics, amounted to a Baconian natural history of history. Birds and bugs, gems and coins, rarities of nature and art, sat side by side in the cabinets of philosophers and gentlemen. Here is a small portion of a gabinetto in Bologna with a living rarity, a dwarf, as Cicerone. And here is the rest of the clutter. The philosophical narrative that would incorporate antiquarian findings in the manner that physical theory would rise from the siftings of Solomon's house was the work of the 18th century and a subject I'll deal with tomorrow. Several auxiliary sciences and a brisk trade in artifacts grew up during the 17th century around the comparative study of ancient monuments. The great antiquary Nicolas de Peresc, who was also a good astronomer and natural philosopher, remarked that coins and metals, ancient and modern, real and fake, were available in such profusion in the markets in Rome that sellers offered them strung together as if necklaces. That gave buyers an additional spur to develop critical antiquarian expertise. Among the disciplines at their disposal in the mid-17th century, at the time that Descartes was writing, were epigraphy, the science of inscriptions, sophrogistics, the science of seals, and numismatics, the study of coins and metals. Here are some numismatical connoisseurs exercising discernment in a market in Rome. The first major application of ancient coins to historical writing was to history as rhetoric. That is, it made available depictions of emperors to go with the usual ancient accounts of their deeds and misdeeds. The first application to unscrambling geography and chronology by Ennio Vico, who is not the great Vico, came at the middle of the 16th century, but had very little influence for 100 years, much as the major innovations in natural science of Vico's time, associated with Copernicus, Vesalius, and Ramus, did not have a wide impact before Galileo, Harvey, and Descartes. But from the middle of the 17th century, most knowledgeable people accepted Vico's dictum that no sound ancient history could be written without reference to coins and metals. Numismatics was but child's play in comparison with diplomatics, a subject at first approached as cold, dry, and repulsive, according to a Dictionnaire de Diplomatique of the 18th century, as cold, dry, and repulsive as calculation with trigonometric functions. In both cases, however, perseverance would be rewarded a thousandfold. Master trigonometry, and you can ascend to the height of the Newtonian world system. Master diplomatics, and you have internalized the, quote, judicious criticism that is the very key to nearly all the sciences. The parallel can be drawn out further. By coincidence or divine plan, the mathematical world system and the critical evaluation of documents fixed their foundations in the same decade, the 1680s. The first in Newton's Mathematical Principles of Natural Philosophy, the second in Jean Mabillon's De Re Diplomatica. As everyone knew, Newton assembled empirical laws found by Kepler and Galileo, critically compared measurements reported by astronomers, transcended the blueprint for a mechanical natural philosophy laid down by Descartes, and with one encompassing law, not only showed that phenomena previously held distinct, like the motions of the planets of the luminaries, the rotations of Jupiter's satellites, the elliptical shape of the Earth, the ocean tides, and the precession of the equinoxes were all consequences of the same simple principle. He also accounted for them in quantitative detail. As not so many know, Mabillon assembled and compared information about the physical makeup of medieval documents collected by himself and other members of the Benedictine convent of Saint-Germain-des-Prés. His research group worked out the styles, inks, parchment, papers, seals, and calendars employed by the various chancelleries, monasteries, cathedrals, cities, regions, nations, and empires at different times, and found enough correspondences to be able to judge decisively whether a test document came from the time and place it claimed. Trithemius could have got nowhere with Mabillon. The answer to Pyrrhonism in history turned out to be the close and critical comparison of original sources for which medieval documents provided the chief material and testbed. It may not be too fanciful to think that the Middle Ages played the same part in historical thinking as the vacuum did in physics. Both were unknown territory in 1550. In the second half of the 17th century, they were the sites of the most progressive research in their respective areas. To pick but one example from history, the half century after 1660 saw the invention almost from whole cloth of Anglo-Saxon studies with their attendant dictionaries, grammars, catalogs, editions, and translations. These instruments had their parallel in physics in the air pump, invented just before 1660, and its paraphernalia, which revolutionized understanding of the nature of matter during the same half century. The parallels between modern history and experimental science that I hope to have made plausible are, if you will believe only half of them, I will be content. A further parallel deserves mention. Distinctions and collections, applications and analogies do not automatically generate what from time to time is accepted as truth. To produce even transient truth, according to Mabillon's Italian disciple Muratori, requires good taste as well. Muratori, the man of good taste, wrote several volumes on buon gusto in all the arts and sciences for the guidance of those who lacked it. This was the early 18th century. His long lesson came down to this. The three fundamental ingredients of good taste are, and I think you can remember this, humility, humility, humility. In this spirit, I quit for the day, humbly confident that you will tell me where I have gone astray, and hopeful that I will see you here tomorrow for a surprising conclusion. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.